As usual, a lot happened in our region this past week, and we'll try to get to as much of it today as we can. Welcome. As always, we're glad you're a part of the full story. Thanks for listening. I'm Ron Ropiak. Coming up, we're going to be discussing why Connecticut Congressman Jim Himes, whom many describe as a moderate, is now saying that it's time for an impeachment inquiry into President Trump. It's a move that has raised a lot of eyebrows. But let's start the show today by calling in Joe Shaw. Joe's our friend. He's the executive editor at 27East.com, the Southampton Press, and the East Hampton Press. Joe, always a pleasure. Thanks for coming on today.
Happy to be here, Ron. Thanks for inviting.
Joe, I want to start with the horrible news from yesterday about the deaths of two girls. Tell us what happened, please. And I also want to remind our listeners that our program is live right now at 1 o'clock or so. But when it's repeated tonight at 7, there may be more details.
Yeah, we're still getting details. And obviously, I think we have a pretty complete picture of what's going on. And it's just a horrific tragedy. Police responded in Montauk yesterday after there was a countywide search for a vehicle. A woman from Medford, her mother had actually called 911 and said that the woman was suicidal and threatening to kill her twin toddlers. And when police actually found the vehicle in Montauk, the twin two-year-old girls were dead. They were taken to the local hospital, but they were pronounced dead at the hospital. Apparently, there wasn't the mother was taken into custody, and she was arraigned this morning, and there was a press conference this morning as well. She's a 24-year-old woman from Medford, and it was twin two-year-old daughters that were found dead. According to the DA's office, there was no outward sign of trauma on the children's bodies, but they're still investigating how she killed the children. Just a terrible story. And, you know, coming on the heels, we had our first murder in Montauk in recent memory just a couple of weeks ago. So just an awful story.
The community must be shaken. Thank you, Joe, for that. It's a sad, as you said, terrible story. Now, moving on, many of us watched the debates the last few nights. One of the main topics was what is going on our southern border and undocumented immigrants. Now, the immigration issue continues to perplex and sadden many, and now there's a great fear for some families on the East End. Tell us about that.
Yeah, we have a very large population. The immigrant population is significant on the East End. I mean, I think in the county it's roughly 20%, but I think the estimates on the East End are a lot higher. And that includes some undocumented men and women. And so all of the talk about the sweeps that came out of the White House this week had a real resonance on the East End, and some of the local organizations very quickly rallied to try and create a response to that. They basically were reaching out locally to work with local organizations to hold workshops to make sure that parents had paperwork in order, and to help employers to understand what they could do. You know, in a busy summer season, in a lot of industries out here, this is when we need all of the workers, and there's no question that some of those workers are undocumented. And to lose a whole, you know, if a sweep came through and took out large numbers of men and women who are working for businesses out here in the middle of summer, it would really be a potential crisis. But obviously, all of that dwarfs the impact on the individual families themselves. And so that's been OLA, which is the local organization on Eastern Long Island, that's sort of the Latino advocacy group, has been doing quite a bit to try and respond to the issues out here and at least get families and to get others ready to respond to it if it does happen.
Joe, I have read that in some communities, families are staying hidden in their homes. They're afraid to go out, afraid to answer the door.
Yeah, I think there's some of that. I think on the South Fork, down here in particular, the local police, I think, have a much less aggressive approach to all these issues. But there's absolutely no question that There's a lot of families who are really concerned that when the, as Minerva Perez, who's with OLA out here, said, you know, black unmarked Escalades roll into town, and you want to think they're going after bad guys or drug sellers or something like that, but there are a lot of families out here who know that's not a good thing for them, and so it does create a lot of stress and a lot of fear among those families. And you know, there's also a lot of families here who have been here long term, and so have children who are actually American citizens, even though the parents are undocumented. So it's a complicated situation. And you think about this issue affecting border communities, but this is one of those areas that is directly affected by the national conversation that's taking place.
Mm. Next story, Joe, concerns a bill that was passed in Albany. The bill is aimed at providing financial assistance to first-time home buyers and plus also for affordable housing projects on the East End. Now, this is obviously a huge problem, not just on the East End, but across the region. What does this bill do?
Yeah, it has the potential to really be significant out here because, so it's patterned on the Community Preservation Fund, which of course was enacted in 99, and that's a 2% tax on all of real estate transfers that happen in the five East End towns of Long Island, and that money goes towards purchasing farmland and preserving open space, and it has been so successful. I mean, spent more than $1 billion since 99 to do that and really changed the face of the East End. A lot of people believe it preserved the face of the East End. This is similar. It would be a 0.5% tax on real estate transactions, but the money would be used for affordable housing. Now, that gets complicated because some of it would be used to build affordable housing, but a lot of it, the idea is to try and do some innovative programs that just make it more affordable to live here for first-time home buyers and for working families. So one of the ideas that's on the table is that this money would be collected by, say, Southampton Town. It would be in a fund that then could be used to do a loan to a home buyer for 50% of the cost of a house. And then that loan wouldn't be repaid until the house was sold, at which time the town would take its money back. So while a family was living in that house, it would only cost them half what it would normally cost as far as a mortgage payment. And the town would be able to recycle that money into the next project once they sell and are able to do something else. You know, it has the potential to be a game changer. It's going to be, I think the devil's going to be in the details about how the towns actually make this work. And that's all, by the way, assuming that the governor signs it, which most people think he will, but you never know for sure. But if he signs it, the heavy responsibility is going to be on the towns to try and figure out how best to use that money.
So if this happens, I want to get to another story, but for a few seconds, if this happens, it'll probably go into effect, what, in a few years?
I think probably if we're lucky and it's signed this in the next couple of weeks, it could go into effect next year as far as collecting money. But I think as far as how the money will be used may take a little more time.
And finally, Joe, as you know, the climate change was a hot topic in the Democratic presidential debates. New York State now has one of the most ambitious climate change legislation in place. A good part of that has to do with wind power. Now, the government wants developers to tell them where they think good locations are to put in the wind turbines, or if you will, wind farms. So where are these new locations that they're proposing?
It's a combination of things. First of all, we have a proposal on the table for the South Fork Wind Farm, which is off of the coast of Montauk, over the horizon for the most part. And that is right now moving through the process to be approved. It's on its way towards an approval, so it's a firm proposal that's out there. That's a fairly big one. But we just learned this past week that the Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is looking at other areas it may open up for wind farms. And actually, three companies have suggested an area off of the south shore of the East End of Long Island. They're calling it the area is called Fairways North. and it's about 18 miles south of the South Fork, and it's about 30 miles out in some sections. And it goes from Mariches Inlet to Montauk Point, basically. But these are three areas. These three companies are looking at this area and pitching very large wind farms and saying that they can make them work. Now, this is not a done deal by any stretch of the imagination, and a lot of people are very concerned about the idea of a wind farm that close to the South Fork. So it's really just a conversation that's taking place, but it's a conversation that took a step forward this past week when the companies stepped up and said they actually have proposals.
When you say over the horizon, that's significant for some because they're very honest. They're saying, we don't want to see these from the beach.
Yeah, the two big impacts are on fishing, and that's the same regardless of where they are. But the South Fork farm is actually far enough out that it probably won't be visible for the most part from Montauk. These are 18 to 30 miles, which is probably far enough out that they wouldn't be significant, but they would be potentially visible depending. And a lot of folks have pointed out they will probably be lighted in some way. And so the visual impact may be one of the big obstacles that those would have if that would ever even become a serious proposal.
It's called fairways.
It's the big battle. I think everybody on the South Fork is in favor of renewable energy, but this is how it gets done. And a lot of people, when it push comes to shove, the idea of wind turbines is one that has some impacts.
Fairways North. Sounds like a golf course, huh?
It sure does. It'd be a lot of water on that course.
Just a lot of water hazards. Joe Shaw, the executive editor at 27east.com, the Southampton Press, and the East Hampton Press. Thank you, Joe. Always a pleasure. We appreciate your time.
Happy to do it, Ron.
Be well. It's the full story on WSHU. We'll be right back. It's the full story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak, and since it's Friday, it's the weekly news roundup. And now I'd like to welcome in Ebong Udama, WSHU's chief political reporter. How are you, bud?
Thank you, Ron.
And joining us on the phone is Emily Munson, who covers the state capitol and just about everything else for Hearst Connecticut Media. Hi, Emily. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Happy Friday to you. Keith Faniff is going to be joining us in a few minutes. Keith, of course, is from Connecticut Mirror, ctmirror.org. But Ebong and Emily, and I want to start with you because I want to talk a little politics at the beginning. And believe it or not, not about the Democratic presidential debates. I want to talk about Jim Himes. Jim Himes is the Democratic congressman from the 4th District. He's considered by many to be a moderate. Yet earlier this week, he surprised many by calling for an impeachment inquiry into President Trump. Now, Ebong, you have known and you have covered the congressman for a number of years. Did this surprise you?
I don't think so, because I think I had spoken with Himes before, and he serves on the House Intelligence Committee. And so he has had to deal with the Trump administration and with the Russian, the whole investigation into Russia's involvement in the elections. So he's had a front row seat on this, and he's been quite exasperated. And as a matter of fact, right after he gave his floor speech announcing that he would support impeachment, I got him on the phone, and I was surprised because he said the Republicans in his district were part of the reason why he made his decision. And here's what he told me.
There are lots and lots of Republicans in Fairfield County who are outraged by this president. And so, you know, the fact that I was hearing from people who used to be Republicans that they supported an impeachment inquiry was pretty powerful. And remember, as we talk about this, we really are talking about an impeachment inquiry. I'm careful to note that that is simply a public airing in the House of Representatives of facts I don't believe that there is any chance that an impeachment would remove the president from office, given that the Senate would, in my mind anyway, never convict him. So this is really an opportunity, one, to stand up for the Constitution, to do what Mueller recognized was the next step, which was Congress picking up the story, and to provide a public airing of the president's behavior. And then, you know, let's see where that takes us.
So basically, that was his reasoning. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting that it came just a couple of days after Nancy Pelosi, the speaker, was in Connecticut and reinforcing her objection to going ahead with an impeachment inquiry at this time.
I also want to mention that Congressman Himes will be here on Tuesday, and he's going to be a guest on our program, and this obviously will be one of the major topics. Emily, many have said that the progressive wing is asserting itself in a much more robust way nowadays. Is this a sign of this?
No, I don't believe that Jim Himes is stating that he's in favor of an impeachment inquiry is a sign of the strength of the progressive wing, because Himes does not identify with that wing. He firmly and repeatedly identifies as a more moderate part of the party, a Democrat who can win in a part of Connecticut that has traditionally been red. And, you know, he's been a leader of a coalition of such Democrats across the country. So I don't think he's being swayed by the progressives, but I think, as Ebong pointed out, he's being influenced by the increasing evidence from what he's hearing in committees, and as well as the Mueller report about, you know, possible wrongful or suspicious conduct by the president.
Before we move on to the next topic, any news about an impeachment inquiry or thoughts on impeachment from the rest of the Connecticut delegation, Ebong?
No, no one else has said anything. No one else has said it. And as a matter of fact, on last Friday, the general consensus was everyone supports Nancy Pelosi's position.
I'd like to move on to our next topic, which continues to be something that we talk about on a weekly basis. We could just do a weekly news roundup on this one topic. That is tolls. Governor Ned Lamont wants them. He says the future of the state and its economy depends on having them installed. Keith Faniff is with us. Keith, always a pleasure to have you. Where does this stand now in Hartford?
Nice to be here, gentlemen. Right now, the best way to describe tolls for this year is in limbo, maybe in limbo with a long shot of getting out of it. I wouldn't place them in the 0% possibility, but it wouldn't be a very high positive number, I would say. The real test is going to be how confident the Democratic majority in the Senate feels. Just to remind everybody, we're talking about a 22-14 split. But the estimate is that tolls right now, if there was a vote, would go 18-18. Now, on paper, you're still okay because the Lieutenant Governor Susan Bisewitz would then break the tie, presumably since the Lamont administration wants that. She would vote for tolls, and that would be that. But there's no margin for error there, and the Democratic majority only has to think back to a couple of years ago when it was 18-18 in the Senate, and they thought they could hold their 18 together and run a budget, a Democratic budget, and get the Lieutenant Governor to pass it. It fell apart. The Democrats effectively lost their little working majority, and they don't appear to be ready to risk it over tolls.
Emily, so the question of a special session continues to confound me. Will a session take place over the summer? If it does happen, will it take place in the fall? How does this work?
So we don't know yet when a special session may take place. Essentially, when the governor and legislative leaders agree on a piece of legislation, a tolls deal, that they believe they have the votes to pass. They will then issue a call for a special session, and lawmakers will return to Hartford to vote. So the timing will all depend on when the governor and legislative leaders can create a deal that they think will pass. Also, legislative vacations are a factor in this. The House Majority Leader Matt Ritter told me that there will not be a tolls vote in August because too many lawmakers will be away. So that leaves us July, and then, following that, September and the fall. And with increasing calls from some top Democrats to reach a tolls deal that will receive some Republican votes, it's more likely that this is going to take some time and we will not have a special session very soon.
Abong, will the Republicans in any way support any kind of toll proposal?
It's hard to say. Right now, they feel that they're in a strong position. They feel that if the Democrats had the votes, this would have been a done deal a long time ago. And the reason why it hasn't been, they haven't brought out a tolls bill is that they don't have the votes for it. And now that they're reaching out to Republicans, it puts them in a much stronger position. And as a matter of fact, Lamont said this week that within the next 10 days or so, he'd be meeting with legislative leaders to try and work out something. So we'll see how that works out. But the Republicans feel that right now they feel that they're in a strong position of trying to prevent tolls from happening. So we'll see how that works out over the summer.
Keith, what will this do to the governor's economic plan and his stature if this doesn't go through? Can he recover from a defeat on this?
I'll take the easier question first. Economic plan, I don't think this year's vote on tolls has a big effect in the long term on the economic plan, only in the sense that Connecticut's done so much damage to its transportation system already by not having a long-term plan, even if you could snap your fingers and in the next 10 seconds have a long-term financing plan with or without tolls. It would take years just to catch up on all the maintenance we deferred. I mean, we have over $4 billion worth of transportation borrowing that's been approved not only by the legislature, but also by the State Bond Commission that hasn't actually been executed. In other words, we haven't gone down to Wall Street and actually borrowed the money. The financing only exists on paper because we don't have the money in the budget. Once you borrow money, you have to start making payments on it. We don't have the money in the budget to cover the payments. So as far as an economic plan, that wasn't going to happen. As far as the stature, I mean, tolls was kind of bungled from the beginning. Everybody's already established. You know, he said in the campaign he was only going to toll trucks. There was never any evidence at all that that would generate the type of money that was needed. And he was asked about that repeatedly during the campaign. He did not come up with a good message to cover the reversal of their opinion. The bigger problem I think that he faces is, I agree with Emily that there's not going to be a special session this summer, most likely, on tolls. They will have to come in to clean up the bond package, but that they could do in one day. And what are the odds of them voting on tolls in an election year, a legislative election year next year, which means everything gets pushed off until the 2021 cycle? And believe it or not, that's about when the gubernatorial campaign starts to ramp up. So if we also happen to be sliding economically into recession, if Governor Lamont has any plans to run for reelection, tolls may go on a shelf, which is why he knows this year's his best shot, but that shot's almost gone.
You're listening to The Full Story on WSHU. He's Keith Fanna from ctmirror.org, connecticutmirror.org. Emily Munson is also with us from Hearst Connecticut Media, and in the studio with me, Abong Udama, WSHU's chief political reporter. Let's talk about the Connecticut budget now, Ebon. Governor Lamont has signed the budget. It's a two-year budget, and it's $43.4 billion.
Well, let's start with listening to what Lamont said just yesterday at a lunch at the Fairfield Business Council lunch yesterday. This is what Lamont had to say about the budget.
And that may not seem like that big a deal, but we signed a budget in June. 2 years ago, the last time they did a budget, they signed it in late October, November. And I heard from every mayor and superintendent of schools and first selectman, they all told me pretty much the same thing over the last year, which was, I know we're not going to get a lot more money from you, Gov. I know that we're running pretty tight right now. But can you get me a budget on time so I can plan accordingly? And that's what we did. We got a budget on time, a budget that held the line on spending, a budget that did not increase any income tax or sales tax rates, and that tried to show people that, look, we're beginning to live within our means.
So basically, he feels good about the budget that he signed.
Keith, Republicans say by law it's supposed to be a balanced budget, and they're not sure if what he signed is balanced. Why is that?
Well, and I get what the Republicans are saying. I want to just put a qualifier around on the answer I'm about to give you. I will say it's about as balanced as most state budgets are, but that's kind of grading on the curve. That's kind of like naming it the world's smartest termite. It's not really that great of a compliment to begin with. This budget has big savings assumptions, but that's become standard operating procedure. The Republicans are upset, though, because they feel Governor Lamont's administration has been a little sloppy about them. And what we're talking about is about $450 million over the next two fiscal years that's supposed to come in savings from labor. We want to change not the health benefits in terms of how generous they are to workers, but we want to try to create some efficiencies that'll produce savings. That we can do by working with the labor unions, and it doesn't necessarily have to go to a vote. But we also want to restructure payments or refinance for the second time in 3 years our payments into the state employees' pensions. And that is literally scaling back the amount of money, deferring some of the money we're supposed to put in and to let the next generation put that money in, plus make up all the investment earnings that we're going to forfeit by not paying the full amount. That we can't do unilaterally. That actually has to be ratified by the union's governing board. It doesn't have to go to every rank and file worker, but none of these are a layup. None of these are done. And the fiscal year starts in 3 days. That's one of the big objections that the Republicans have right now.
Emily, I was reading some of the reporting, and the Republicans are very upset about this. They said, look, this doesn't work. They don't know what he's thinking. And they're also worried because some economists have been saying, look, a recession may be coming soon. And so all these projections that you have, they're pie in the sky. What are the Republicans telling you?
Yeah, and one example of this is the Republicans are upset about extra income tax receipts that are built into the new budget. Essentially, for years, going back to about 2009, legislators and governors have based their budget on what's called a consensus revenue, which are figures that are developed by nonpartisan analysts for the governor and the legislative branch. But Governor Lamont, with this budget, did not use those numbers and instead built in an extra $180 million in income tax revenue into his budget. So the Republicans are saying, hold up, how can you include this money that our analysts say is not coming? The governor's administration says the numbers from those analysts are outdated, that more recent numbers from May project higher income tax receipts, so they believe their assumptions are fair. But this is another dispute that Lamont and the Republicans are having.
Keith, we have a minute before we have to take a break. If that $180 million does not materialize, what happens then?
Well, what Emily said is is spot on. They've always, for the last decade, been following those consensus reports. 1 month of revenue is always tempting. 1 month of revenue numbers. In other words, we got the report at the end of April, then we get another report, or they use new numbers that they're using from the end of May. That's not a lot of information. So what happens is you draw the money out of the rainy day fund, and they know they have it. That's why the Republicans are crying foul, because it's kind of like saying, well, we're going to roll the dice, but if we don't get it, we've got this cushion anyway. The point is the state made a pretty firm decision 10 years ago. They weren't going to do that anymore. And this was kind of sloppily moved into the budget.
We've been talking a lot about the budget. We're going to shift gears slightly still. Finances, fiscal, we're going to talk about pensions. The state has been trying to figure out for quite some time how to pay for the pensions that were underfunded. I think Keith explained it to us once. I think they started underfunding these back in 1939. 1939, you think about that. Now they've redone it again, and they're basically shifting billions of dollars in contributions onto taxpayers after 2032. That means your kid, if you have a kid, is going to be paying what we're going to be borrowing now. Now, critics such as David Walker, he's the former U.S. Comptroller General, says all the state did was to stick the next generation with a big bill. Keith, is he right?
Well, he is. There's still some perspective I'd put on that. That is what has been happening, like you pointed out, Ron, for a long time. And what we're doing now is just a modified form of what's been done to us. What happened from 39 until the early 1980s is basically the legislature could pony up however much they wanted. So even though they'd have actuaries who'd say, you know, I'm making up a silly number. You should put in $10, and that's how much we need for every year that these employees are on the job. The legislature, you know, and then we're going to invest it so that when they retire, all the money's there. The legislature just might put in $7 or $5. In the entire decade of the 1980s, when it came to the teachers' pension fund, not 1 year did they put in the full recommended amount for no other reason than because they could. Over time, we've developed certain contractual requirements that have forced us, at least in theory, to put in the full amount, but then we've either gone to the unions or we found other ways to get around those. So this latest refinancing is just sort of the latest end run around those contractual requirements. I will just also quickly point out, we refinanced the state employees' pension in 2017. This year, we refinanced the teachers' pension, and we refinanced the 2017 refinancing of the state employees' pension. I would just raise the question, what makes anyone think this is going to be the last refinancing? This appears to be the new tool to, you know, because there's a convenient message with it. They'll say it's just like refinancing your mortgage, which isn't really the case, but it's become sort of the new tool to push problems down the road, unfortunately making them bigger.
Keith, I know you have to get going in a minute, so I'm just going to ask you one other thing. I should actually say it. I want to give you a compliment about a phrase that you used in your column the other day when you were describing this. And you said basically that comes down to how much are you willing to make your kids borrow so that you can have a nice retirement?
Well, what I was getting at was, I mean, I understand because of the fiscal sins of the past, the pension fund was going, the payments were going to spike. One report had our pension payments, and I'm adding state employees' pension and teachers' pension, our contributions to those together. One report had them going from about $2.5 billion a year up to more than $12.5 billion by 2032. No one was going to make that payment. I am not saying at some point refinancing wasn't going to happen. The question is, have we really reached the breaking point already where we can't stand the pain? Because at the pace we're going, apes will be running the planet before we ever pay off the pension funds. I mean, we've extended this so much that we're still going to be paying on the debt of the past, probably into the early 2050s. And with the teacher's pension, I would just point out, we will actually, for the next two fiscal years, in straight nominal plain old dollars, be paying less than we're paying in the fiscal year that's about to end in 2 days. In other words, we didn't just scale back an increase. We actually decided we needed some relief. That was political expediency. And that's the part where they're saying, well, since I'm already dipping into my kid's college fund, maybe I can have some of his lunch money, too.
Those damn dirty apes may do a better job than us anyway, right?
Thank you, by the way. Nobody else gets the reference. I tried that before a younger crowd run, and I was like Charlton Heston, Statue of Liberty. Nobody got it.
I want you to know, Ann and Joelle and everybody else in the control room, they all got the reference, too. We're full of useless trivia around here, Keith.
They're all as old as I am. Emily's not, but everyone else.
Keith Van of ctmerid.org. Keith, thank you. We always appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Keith. All right, Emily, you're still there, right?
Yes, I am.
Can we switch it back to politics for a little bit? I'm assuming that you watched it. Did you watch the debates?
I did, yes.
Has there been any reaction from the Connecticut congressional delegation? Has anyone said anything about them? Have you heard anything about alliances being formed or how impressed they were by one candidate over another?
No, the congressional delegation has not been speaking out one way or another in favor of candidates. We do know that some of the members of Congress, you know, have alliances with some of these candidates. For example, Chris Murphy is very friendly with Senator Kamala Harris and Senator Cory Booker, and they have had work together on issues in the past, but they're not issuing endorsements of candidates directly yet.
Well, I don't know about the congressional delegation, but I actually watched the debate the other night with a group of Democrats from Trumbull, and the Trumbull Democratic Town Committee in Trumbull organized this, and they had it at a small sports center in Trumbull, and about 40 people were at the bar watching it, and it was quite interesting to see how they were really into what was going on. And I spoke with a couple of people right after the debate was over. This was the first night of debate. And the first person I spoke with was Pat Bogesson, who's she's a member of the Democratic Town Committee in Trumbull, and this is what she had to say.
I think Elizabeth Warren stands out front and center. She has an extraordinary depth in terms of her experience, but I also think she's an extraordinary debater. So that's skill.
Okay. And what do you think is the most important thing for you in this election?
The most important issue for me at this point is to defeat the current incumbent.
And pretty much that was the theme throughout the night. What got the loudest cheer was any attack on Trump. And former Bridgeport Mayor Bill Finch was also in the room, so I got in a word from him about what his takeaway from the first night of debate was.
I think Jay Inslee's got the greatest insight into the existential threat, which is Donald Trump and climate change. But I think every single person from Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker did great. Everybody here was energized. We can win with any of them.
And that's the general feeling with the rank-and-file Democrats. They feel very confident that they have a good crop of candidates, and they were very impressed. And another thing of note is that the ratings on both nights were much higher than had been predicted.
Hmm.
And you know, especially with Pamela Harris from last night, she has actually broken out, and so we'll see how that manifests itself going forward. But but from the grassroots Democrats here, they seemed excited that night.
Kamala Harris was a standout last night. It was a pretty amazing performance, along with Pete Buttigieg. But both of them getting a lot of applause today. So, Emily, I guess, as in the past many times, I guess the party is hoping that when the nominee is decided, they'll all come together, sing Kumbaya, and that'll be it, huh?
Yeah, that's usually how this goes. You start with a division, and you try to end up with a unified party that can prevail with one candidate.
Emily, while I got you on politics, just one last thing, and then I'm going to move on to one or two other stories. The state GOP reelected its chairman, J.R. Romano. Any big surprises there?
No, he was predicted to win. This was, you know, a small but at times hot competition. There were four candidates originally running. One of them did drop out on the day of the vote, and JR was reelected by the 70-some-odd Republican party members who are allowed to cast their vote for the chairman.
Well, I don't think it was a surprise. I don't think right now the Republicans are in a difficult position in Connecticut because they have headwinds coming from Washington. And remember that next year is a presidential election year. So the what's going to drive people to the polls is not going to be so much the local issues. It's going to be the national presidential race. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Trump does very well in Connecticut. So they're going to have to try and win elections. They've got to try and be Republicans without totally embracing Trump. So it's going to be a difficult time. So whoever is going to be chair of the Republican Party is going to have a very tightrope to walk.
After when we first started this program back in November, right after the elections, we had Themis Claridis on the program, and she is the House Minority Leader, and we were talking about the results of the election, and she was very honest. She said, this was a vote on Donald Trump, and it's something that we have to consider for the future. How do we differentiate ourselves from him? And she was very outspoken about it, and she said, we have to remind people what the Republicans in Connecticut stand for, what it is that we are concerned about. So it's an issue that they're going to have to confront over the next year or so.
And I don't see it being much different from what happened last year, because the chair was J.R. Romano, and we're going to have J.R. Romano still in the seat. So.
Emily, the U.S. Supreme Court made a decision yesterday on the citizenship question for the 2020 census, or some would argue that maybe they didn't make a decision, or at least a final one. So there's a big question as to whether or not it's going to be included in the next census. But from what I've been reading in the papers this morning and from columns, officials are worried that the damage has already been done, that people are simply scared. Are they?
I think that depends on what you talk to, but that's definitely the concern among officials, is they believe that President Trump's statements about immigrants and migrants to this country have put fear into those communities, and they will not want to engage with government in the way that they have in the past. That includes, you know, seeking help from police and participating in things like the census. And the participation of immigrants in the census, regardless of whether or not they are citizens, is really important, because the census is used to distribute political power. It's used to award seats in Congress, and it also influences federal aid to cities and states and other government functions. So, you know, Connecticut officials really, and officials around the country, have a motivation in having all of their citizens counted so that they can receive more federal dollars and have more representation in Congress.
And, you know, it's a very sensitive issue in Connecticut, because we've been losing
congressional seats. And so Connecticut is very concerned that every single person is counted. And the Lamont administration has gone out of its way to try and stimulate as much interest in the census as possible. They've been out in the urban centers and the rural areas trying to get people ready to take part in the census. And it's really important for Connecticut.
And finally, before we close, Emily, I just want to touch on some business news for a second. Hubble Incorporated says it's closing its electrical components factory in Newtown. And Hubble says it's going to take place over the next 6 months or so, and 140 jobs will be lost. And about 3 weeks ago, it said it was closing its plant in Bethel. That's another 54 jobs, so a total of 194 jobs. The work is going to move to Puerto Rico and to Alabama. What are you hearing from members of the business community in Connecticut?
Well, I'm hearing more from politicians about this, who view this as another bad sign. Republicans are quick to say that this is an indication that Connecticut has a business unfriendly reputation and atmosphere. And Democrats are quick to frame this change as a business decision independent of the political climate. It's a similar conversation as the one that we heard when earlier in June, United Technologies Corporation, based in Farmington, said it was going to merge with Raytheon and move its corporate headquarters to the Boston area. State politicians are very eager to keep businesses here, and Connecticut has not always had a great track record of doing that.
You know, Governor Lamont touched on this yesterday, and he gave an example of the UBS headquarters in Stamford, where we had the biggest trading floor in the U.S., which no longer exists now. Well, that trading floor, he says, has now been taken over by a video production company, and they're going to have the biggest group of video editors in that same space. And his analogy was, look, this is the natural evolution of business. And certain businesses grow and become large, and then they move on, and other businesses take their place. And that we should not be that concerned, because this is a natural evolution. And he also gave the example of the Amazon headquarters that was built in, that's about to open in North Haven. And maximum, they're going to probably hire about 3,000 at the most. And it's in a facility that used to house a Pratt & Whitney factory that had 15,000 employees. But that's the evolution of industry.
Eban Gudama, WSHU's chief political reporter, and Emily Munson, who covers the state capitol and a lot of other things for Hearst Connecticut Media. Emily, thank you. Eban, thank you as always.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you.
That's it for our show today. Joelle Schrock, our Planet of the Apes expert, is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez, the senior producer. Terry Sheridan, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being a part of The Full Story.